Welcome back. This is the latest episode of the Dan Time Podcast. I'm Dan McArdle. Thanks for listening and being a part of the show and enjoying the range of guests. You really never know from week to week who's coming, who you might see, who you might recognize. But it's always, as you know, I've got a recurring group of guests, friends, family, and it's just always something I get excited about for the entire week when we have one of these episodes coming back, because I'm bringing a fan favorite back to the show here, his first appearance since his annual Halloween episode. He's had two in a row. This is my brother, Rob McArdle, to discuss a very cool, very fun, exciting topic. Rob, how are you doing today? Robert, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm glad to be here, and that makes my day. I didn't know I was a fan favorite, but yeah. Glad to be on the cast.
The reason we're doing this today, it's not the 4th of July or Halloween or an episode where you're used to seeing Rob on the show, but I just could not get out of the 80s here. We've been running through episodes, you know, 80, 81, 85, and here we are up on episode number 89. And so I reached out to my brother and said, listen, let's do an episode where we talk about 1989, and we narrowed it down to our top five glam metal, hair metal, sleaze metal, whatever you want to call it, top five albums from that year, and maybe also some special memories from being 10, 11 years old at that time. So here he is today, and we have, if you've listened to the previous episodes with Rob, or Robert as I call him, he's a wealth of knowledge on this particular genre. He waves the flag. I wave the flag. I think that this music is enjoyed, but it's not respect. It's still just not respected enough. Some of the bands, some of the topics, some of the themes, and the innuendo and stuff, yes, I can see where it just doesn't sit up there with, you know, your Springsteens and your Beatles and your Paul Simons of the world. But some of these artists, and particularly the, you know, rhythm guitar players, the primary songwriters, the bass players, are just highly talented, influential performers and musicians. And this music was just, Rob, would you agree? It was just a fun time to be here.
It was a blast. You know, and sometimes rock and roll is meant to just be fun. You know, you don't have to be saving the whales or taking on some big social issue. Sometimes, you know, you just want to party and meet girls and take illicit substances and just have a good time. And, you know, these songs, I grew up with these songs. I love these songs. I love these bands. This is my favorite form of music. And it just doesn't get any better than that. Not that I'm doing any of the things that that they sing about anymore. you know, I've outgrown some of that, but it's still just such a fun part of rock and roll, heavy metal to listen to, and it never gets old for me.
And what you just said there reminds me of the Poison mega anthem, Nothing But a Good Time.
Yeah.
I think from our perspective, Robert, let's just say had we been born in the early 70s, mid 70s, and that makes us 16 or 19 or early 20s in 1988, 89, maybe it's a different experience. You know, we're partying, we're doing the drugs and the booze and the excess and all that stuff, but we were 10. We were attracted to the bright colors, the bright lights, the outfits, the hair.
But these guys were larger than life, you know, which you don't see that anymore, probably thanks to the internet. But yeah, it was just it was amazing to see it through the eyes of a 9 or 10 year old, as opposed to someone who's older. Now, had we been older, you know, yeah, we would have been partying, doing drugs, all that, but we also would have been able to see some of these guys live in concert. I didn't see Motley Crue for the first time until 1999. I didn't see Poison for the first time until, I think it was 2000 or 2001. I think the only time we saw somebody like that was Aerosmith and White Lion back in 1988. And that's only because we begged our parents to take us.
You're right.
But just, you know, it's just something that you don't see anymore with rock stars and rock and roll, heavy metal, just that larger than life image, you know, getting the magazines and reading about the new album that's coming out. Can't wait to hear it. Have to listen to 10 songs on the radio before you hear that one, or watch, have to sit through 10 videos on MTV before you see that Skid Row video that you've been waiting to see. So it just, what a wonderful time it was for rock music back then, and music in general.
Yeah, I mean, and just looking at life in 1989, now, depending on how you grew up, where you grew up, there was a lot of unrest in the world, as there always is. But just look at some of the box office hits from this year. Top grossing release 1989, Batman. Then you've got Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Lethal Weapon 2, Rain Man, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. So all this in this one year. Back to the Future 2, When Harry Met Sally, Field of Dreams, Uncle Buck, Pet Sematary, Robert.
Yeah, that's a good one.
National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Don't forget UHF came out that year, too.
Yeah. Major League, Steel Magnolias, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. I'm sure we'll touch on that in this episode, the soundtrack. Lean on Me, Roadhouse, Robert, Roadhouse.
Roadhouse. I mean, that movie never gets old.
So, yeah, just being a kid, going to the movies, going to the music store, watching MTV, playing outside, just doing the things that we did at 10 years old. It was a magical time to be alive. And the music was just, once we get into, what we're going to do today, folks, is, and this is mirroring what one of Robert's favorite podcasts that he turned me on to, became one of mine, the 80s Glam Metalcast. They do a lot of top 10s and top 5s of so many different categories. They've probably done one like this on a prior episode, but we're going to put together our top 5 glam rock / hair metal releases of 89, going from number 5 to number 1. So this should be exciting, Robert. I think I have an idea of 2 or maybe 3 bands that might be on both of our lists, but I don't know after that.
I guess we got to see. We got to wait. We got to find out.
And as you were saying, let's just, another big thing about 89, it was just this tipping point. There was a lot of, this was the birth of bands that would take over the music scene. Debut albums from Nirvana came out in 89, Bleach. Debut album from, or major label debut from Soundgarden, Louder Than Love. You've got The Offspring, self-titled.
Yeah.
Then you've also got stuff like Billy Joel, Stormfront, Bonnie Raitt. She's back in a big way with Nick of Time.
Yeah.
You got the B-52s, Cosmic Thing, Phil Collins, Chris Isaak. What a year. But anyway, let's get to it. We'll do a sequence here where you announce your pick for number 5, number 4, and so on, and then I'll follow up behind you and we'll comment. So Who do you have at number 5 glam metal releases for 89?
I'm going to go with Alice Cooper, Trash.
Wow.
This was, you know, he had did his thing in the 70s, and then in the 80s he kind of reinvented himself more as straight-ahead heavy metal and glam. And then he does Trash in 1989, co-writes it with Desmond Child, who co-wrote a lot of stuff back then. But just a great, great record. You know, of course, the main hit, Poison, that song never gets old for me. But Spark in the Dark, House of Fire, both great songs. Only My Heart Talking is a great ballad. This Maniac's in Love with You. Just all the way through, just a really solid record from Alice Cooper. So that's my number 5.
Wow. I remember when that came out. I remember the video for Poison.
That is still on the rotation on the Friday and Saturday night YouTube glam metal fest that I usually do with the wife every weekend.
Wow.
Yeah.
This was kind of a comeback for Alice Cooper.
Yeah,
I don't know really through the early 80s or mid 80s if he had really been on MTV much.
He did some stuff, you know, Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives came out in 86, and he contributed to that soundtrack with a couple of songs, then came out with an album called Constrictor, which is also pretty good. And then he had another album after that. I can't remember the name of it. I just remember the main single was Raise Your Fist and Yell. But Trash, I mean, that just got huge. And just a very solid record that he put out there in 89.
Wow. I say wow a lot. Probably, I don't know where the wow-o-meter is all time on this podcast, but anytime that I utter it, I have been wowed. Robert, we were talking right before the start of this episode. I had a relatively easy time just kind of popping in my 1, 2, and 3 and just looking at them and saying, well, I'll move the order around here at the end. But those are definitely in there. Number 4 and 5, this was, I pulled some hair out on this one. Coming in at number 5, I've got Faster Pussycat, Wake Me When It's Over.
Oh, wow. What a good one.
This is a band.
They've been in the news lately.
Oh, no, that I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, go ahead and tell me what about Wake Me When It's Over, and I'll fill you in on the news.
Well, I think the key component to any glam metal, hair metal release from the late 80s is it doesn't have to be the best song. It doesn't have to be the reason why you love the album, but the ballad needs to be powerful. It needs to carry a lot of weight. It can't just be about a love infatuation. It can't, you know, Aerosmith and Angel, I love that song. I love Poison's I Won't Forget You. I love this stuff. But after 86 and 87 and even 88, some of those songs are already out there. I want that ballad from 89 to be a little more, you know, let's go outside the box here. And I just think that Faster Pussycat, they really didn't even want to have to write this song. But House of Pain is, I mean, it just transcends demographics. I think it appeals to people who don't listen to this type of music all the time. What more sensitive subject can you get than abandonment? You know, abandonment is a huge topic.
Yeah, and it's a great song, and it's really not the one you'd expect from a band like Faster Pussycat, which is really just sleazy, and it was all about just the party, especially if you listen to their debut album. But House of Pain is a very powerful power ballad. It's a powerful ballad.
Yeah, but if you listen to the rest of the album, starting with Where There's a Whip, There's a Way, to me, the reason that they wound up on the list at number 5, and I left another couple bands off, is when you listen to this CD, this record, we call it CDs, it sounds like a band you want to see live. You want to be in that club, that concert hall, right up there on the rail, just in the midst of it. They just sound like a sleaze, blues-oriented rock and roll band. Slip of the Tongue.
Good one.
Crying Shame.
Please Dear is another good one. Very bluesy, kind of mid-tempo, almost a ballad.
But Tame Me Down, the, I guess, chief songwriter, founder of the band, he's the only original member, and they didn't just keep cranking out records. So I think they've only got like 4 studio albums all time, 87, 89, and a couple more. But this release, I keep coming back to it.
Yeah. Sadly, they were in the news recently. Tame Me Down's wife sadly took her life during the Monsters of Rock cruise under suspicious circumstances. But it turns out he was later cleared. She had intentionally jumped into the ocean, and they couldn't determine whether or not she jumped, fell, or was pushed, but video evidence supposedly shows that she jumped on her own and he was cleared. But a sad story nonetheless. But great band and a great number five pick. I'm wowed by that. You wowed me.
Well, as you just pointed out, it's not all about the party. Usually, in some way or another, tragedy encircles some of these bands, and we'll get to some of that in another couple picks here. But that's a band I would just love to see live.
Yeah,
and I actually, Robert, I think that they reformed in 2001, and at that time, at the Nick in Birmingham, I think they were playing the Nick, and there was a reason I couldn't go. Always regret it.
I think I vaguely remember that. I didn't go either.
Well, who comes in at number four for you?
Number four is going to be Freely's Comet, second sighting. Ace Freely's second outing with Freely's Comet.
Nice.
Pretty fun record. The main single was Insane, but It's Over Now is a great ballad. Juvenile Delinquent, great song. Loser in a Fight, just another banger of a rocker. Solid, solid record altogether. I listen to it a lot. I listen to it a lot when I grill. It's also, you know, on the YouTube playlist. But just a solid record from Freely's Comet. The fourth and fifth picks of this were a bit tough for me to come up with. You know, one, two, and three are going to be pretty easy. But yeah, Freely's Comet, second sighting. Check it out.
Well, I'm going to have to get back into it. I have to admit, I have no emotional connection to that record. But I did purchase, I think, the first Freely's Comet album.
It's a good one with Rock Soldiers and
yeah.
Into the Night, There in the Night.
Just never really, I like Ace from Kiss, but the lyrics I thought were just lacked just even the smallest depth.
I mean, they're stupid, but the music rocks, you know?
Yeah.
I don't always really get into the lyrics, you know? I mean, if it's got a beat that, you know, just makes me want to bang my head, you know, I don't really care what he's singing about. But yeah, I get you. I mean, his lyrics are dumb.
But, you know, when you're Ace Frehley, you can always put a project together and just let it rip.
Yeah.
And I think, just looking up here, Anton Figg played drums on some of those early Frehley's Comet albums.
Yeah.
And it was part of the Paul Schaefer band.
Yeah. Well, if you ever...
Recorded with Kiss.
Yeah, he did. Well, if you ever watch the video for Insane, it is ridiculous. It's, it's a celebration of everything that I guess hair metal was sort of ridiculed for in the 90s. But it's a fun video, but it is absurdly ridiculous.
I think, you know, Ace Frehley, you know, anybody that has a nickname in rock and roll, he really wears it well. Space Ace, he just is kind of in his own world. And thank God he embraced sobriety as long ago as he did, because I think he'd be long gone.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I love Kiss. You know, Peter and Ace, you know, I love them as musicians. I love Ace's music. I don't know if he's somebody I'd want to hang out with. I've lost some respect for him over the last few years, just some of the stuff he's done on the side, but I've always loved his music. And, you know, I had to put Freely's Comet at number four on this 89 countdown.
Well, I think you will be pleased to hear my number four. I hope so.
I can't wait. Yeah.
Coming in at number four, Brittany Fox, Boys in Heat.
Oh my God. That totally slipped my mind. I mean, I've got this huge list, and I mean, and I listen to that album all the time. I can't believe that it completely slipped my mind. Poor Brittany Fox.
Well, we've got a record store here in Pensacola, the Music Box. And before, I still had a CD player in my last vehicle a few years ago, so I would still stop in there, just kind of hunt around for old releases that maybe I missed or wanted to check out again.
Yeah.
And I think I just bought that on a whim because I remember hearing Brittany Fox on your stereo in our 20s and, you know, back in that time period.
Yeah.
What was that first album?
It was just self-titled debut.
Yeah. But so I checked out Boys in Heat and just right out the gate, I mean, right from the start, the first track In Motion, it's, and especially if you're driving around and you're just having a day and you put that in, it's like, whoa, okay. It's kind of the same thing, if you put in a great AC/DC album. I always think that they're kind of a combination. If AC/DC and Cinderella had spawned a child.
Yeah. Yeah, good call.
There's some similarities, I think, with Tom Kiefer's vocal style and Dizzy Dean Davidson. But they are just a unit. It's a very, very crisp sounding record, start to bottom. It's just all killer, no filler, as they say. They've got that the Hair of the Dog cover, the Nazareth song.
Yeah, pretty good. That album should have gotten bigger, but I know Dizzy Dean was getting ready to leave the band, and the record company didn't really promote it. But yeah, just from start to finish, I prefer it to the debut.
Yeah.
And even the one they did after that, Buy Down Hard with Tommy Paris as a new singer, is a pretty solid record. But Boys in Heat, that's a great pick. I wish I'd have picked that. That's not even on my list. I should redo my list.
I almost missed it.
Yeah.
Because if you do a wide open search for, what are the best hard rock or metal albums from 89, and it's not included on some of the catalogs.
Yeah, and I like to consider myself an expert in glam or hair metal, but I didn't discover this album until about 12, 13 years ago. I mean, I had the debut album, and I like Brittany Fox, but it never occurred to me, oh, did they have other albums? And then all of a sudden, I just looked and found these other two and just fell in love with them. So it's a shame that album didn't get bigger than it was.
I'm going to try to pluck three favorite songs here. Looking at side one, Standing in the Shadows, Long Way from Home, and I'm going to go with Plenty of Love.
Plenty of Love is banger.
Top three. And speaking of Brittany Fox, Michael Kelly Smith, lead guitarist in the 80s glam metal cast. I'll try to link it if I can, but listen to that episode. As Robert said, some of these bands, it was a timing thing. It was a label priority thing where they just got lost in the shuffle. But if you listen to this album, coming back to what I was saying earlier, a lot of these bands get passed over. It's just not, they're just not culturally acceptable to list as influences. Like, oh, what are some of your favorite records? Well, I always like, people just easily rattle off the Stones or the Hendrix or the, if you listen to this album, you can hear the hard work that they put into recording it, writing and recording these songs.
Yeah. I would like to add that Stevie, Left Me Stray, and Long Road are also some standout tracks on the album.
Yeah. I'll tell you, if you like to air drum like I do, especially while you're driving and doing it safely, you're going to have a blast with this record.
Absolutely.
Robert, who do you have? I can't believe we're already at number three. But again, we didn't do a top 10 or we'd be talking for 2 hours.
Oh, I know.
Who comes in at number three?
This is where it gets a little bit easier for me. Number three is going to be Motley Crue's Dr. Feelgood.
Oh, there it is.
And Motley is probably my favorite band, has been my favorite band of all time for years. The only reason this isn't number one is because there are several throwaway songs on this album that I just don't care for. That being, I get them out of the way, Time for Change is one of the dumbest ballads I've ever heard. I can't just see Motley Crue, doing their thing with groupies, with drugs, going on tour, having a good time, and then, the next day saying, hey, there's some starving kids out there, we got to get the message out.
Agreed. It does not It does not belong on the record. End it with Don't Go Away Mad, crew.
Yes, absolutely. I'd like to, and I'd also like to put Without You, the other ballad on there. Doesn't really do anything for me. The rest of the album, I think, just is a total banger. I've recently listened to the title track a few times after not caring to hear it for years because it was so overplayed. That song rocks. Slice of Your Pie, just a great solo from Mick, a great sleazy riff in that song. I know Rattlesnake Shake gets a lot of hate because of the horn section, but I think it's got a great driving riff during the verses. Kickstart My Heart is a bit overplayed, so I usually don't really listen to that one, although on the reissue, they have a demo of Kickstart My Heart that I actually enjoy more. But then you've got, I think the banginest song on the album is She Goes Down.
Oh, really?
Yeah, is pure glam. Just pure glam goodness. And every time when I'm listening to that record, that song comes up, I just crank it to 11. So great record from Motley, Dr. Feelgood. It's not my favorite Motley Crue album, but it is my number three for 89. And probably their last really good record. I do like the self-titled one they did with Karabi, and New Tattoo has its moments, and even Generation Swine. But Dr. Feelgood, that's the peak of their career. So that's my number three.
Well, I agree with just about everything you said there. It hits on everything that you need, every box you need to check to just be a monstrous record.
Yeah.
The album cover, iconic.
Yeah.
The videos. The singles for the record, I think there's five. There's the title track, Kickstart My Heart, Without You. They, a couple singles at the end of, or it's released in August of 89. So Dr. Feelgood and Kickstart My Heart, the two singles that year. 1990, it's still all over the radio, all over MTV, Without You. Don't Go Away Mad, Just Go Away. I think my favorite song on the record.
Oh, it never gets old.
And video. And Same Old Situation. And again, what makes a great album? It's highly influential. People, other bands hear it, and they say, I want to do that too. I want to do a version of that.
Metallica.
Who produced that? Bob Rock.
Yeah.
If you listen to Dr. Feelgood, the way that this album starts off with that dun 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 dun,
yeah.
And then how does Metallica's Black Album start off with the bass and toms of Inner Sandman?
And look, I get some hate for this, but the Black Album still is my favorite Metallica album. It's so well produced, just like Dr. Feelgood. And Lars hears Dr. Feelgood and says, we want to sound like that. Not necessarily glam, but we want to have that production value. And Bob Rock, love him or hate him, he can make a record sound great. Listen to the Cult's Sonic Temple, which also came out in 89. He did that. So yeah, just masterfully produced. So if it wasn't for Bob Rock producing, the Black Album might sound different.
Absolutely. And again, we didn't share these lists prior to recording today, but Robert, my number three is also Dr. Feelgood.
Ah, how about that?
And some reasons why it's not number one, I kind of agree with you. Some of the, when you get outside the singles, there are some records where you got the singles and then there's a lot of air between those songs and the deep album cuts that you just skip over. There's some bands that there's 10 tracks and two of those are the singles and the other eight songs are just about garbage. But it's not really the case here. I do like Sticky Sweet. I think some people don't like that one. I like Rattlesnake Shake.
Yeah.
Can't Stand Time for Change.
No.
Without You, I'm in agreement. They really could have done a better job here. There's nothing close to Home Sweet Home as far as a ballad on here. That was their shot at it. And the other singles, I think, pick it up a little bit. I mean, Without You did well, but for me, it's 4.5 minutes. It's probably a minute and a half too long.
Yeah. Yeah. It's same old situation. It's overplayed for me, but my God, yeah. Sticky Sweet is great. And I go back to She Goes Down. I mean, just a total banger. And I mean, what more can you say about the record? I mean, gosh, I was rocking out to that this weekend.
And here's another thought. So Dr. Feelgood comes out the summer of 89. There's a lot happening, a lot of great movies. There's other albums of this caliber or of this genre that are just, they're just pumping them out all year, 1989. They're on MTV. If you're a band that, because Motley Crue was about almost 10 years in at this point, but if you're a band that just got started, was trying to break through big time like Britney Fox, and Feel Good is all over the place, you've got to be, excuse me, feeling pretty good about this movement lasting a few more years. Who in the world would have thought that, you know, 1990 is kind of like the end when you have a record like this and the tour and the receipts that this...
Nikki Sixx, he did point that out in an interview on the Dr. Feelgood tour where he was saying that it's getting to the point where everybody's looking the same, everybody's sounding the same, and something needs to happen to shake everything up. And I guess little did he know that that would be Nirvana a couple of years later, and his band, it would sort of change the course of Nikki's band and a lot of other bands. But yeah, you can see it. I mean, it's so just everybody's riding high, and this is never going to end. You know, I mean, how could you not be on cloud nine?
And before we wrap up here, Tommy Lee, personality-wise, some of my favorite musicians or drummers, I like them on record, I like them on stage, and I might have different thoughts about them beyond that, but this record, and then the John Corabi album as well, just cements Tommy Lee as one of my favorite Styxmen of all time.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Let's move it along here. We're at the top two. Can't wait to hear. I know what I've got left, and I'm wondering, one of these has to be your pick. Who do you have at number two, Robert?
My number two is Warrant's debut album, Dirty, Rotten, Filthy, Stinking Rich.
There it is.
just a total banger all the way through. I will say that I don't really listen to Heaven very much. It's been overplayed for me, and Warrant has a lot better ballads than that. But, I mean, just from the start, I mean, 32 Pennies, Down Boys, you know, and then you get into some of the deeper tracks like Riding High, In the Sticks, title track, just great stuff. You know, Big Talk was a single. Sometimes She Cries. Actually, I like Sometimes She Cries as a ballad better than Heaven. But just from start to finish, I mean, you could listen to that and not really skip a song. And the same with their follow-up, Cherry Pie. But Dirty, Rotten, Filthy, Stinking Rich, the only reason I have it above Motley Crue is because other than Heaven, and even sometimes with Heaven, I can listen to that and not skip a single song. Just a great glam record. They do it about as good as Poison does.
Warrant is one of my all-time favorite bands from this era. Coming back to what's popular to say, what everybody else lists, you know, oh, who's your favorite vocalist? You know, and not many people say, I love Janie Lane.
Yeah.
I do, because I've listened to the records. If you listen to the music and you listen to the heart behind some of these songs and just the talent, this guy was loaded with talent.
Yeah, and I said earlier that I don't always listen to the lyrics. When it comes to Janie Lane, just an underrated songwriter, never got the acclaim that he deserved, but a true talent, and sadly he's no longer with us, and I wish he was, but just...
Yeah, we watched
the most talented songwriter of the glam genre.
We watched that episode, the episode of That Metal Show.
Yeah.
I think in the summer of 2010, which was recorded weeks before he died.
Yeah, it was like 2 weeks.
And I just remember he did not look good.
No.
Eddie Trunk, as he usually does. I don't think he means anything by it, but he just said, you know, how you doing? How you doing, Janie? Are you health-wise? You feeling good? It's like, I don't know. He doesn't look good. But some tumultuous years there at the end. I don't think he was particularly easy to work with for the other guys in the band, and some disappointment that follows heavy substance abuse and people counting on you and performances and stuff like that. But if you go back to the heyday here, just what a talent. And Warrant is another band. So they're out there playing the clubs, paying their dues from like the mid-80s.
Yeah.
4 or 5 years, or maybe 6 years. Maybe, 4 or 5 years until the breakthrough.
Yeah.
And for me, with Warrant, they're one of those bands that each record is the better record to me once you get up to Dog Eat Dog. And then it steps back a little bit with Ultraphobic. But I think Cherry Pie is better than the debut, and the debut is great. And I think Dog Eat Dog is probably their best record.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I listen to Cherry Pie more than Dog Eat Dog. I think I would say Cherry Pie is a more fun record. Dog Eat Dog is superior because the writing is just so good. But I wouldn't necessarily call it a fun party record. But it should have gotten more acclaim than it did. And I agree with you. Dog Eat Dog is probably Warrant's best album. Ultraphobic is good, and I do listen to it, because it does have some of that classic Warrant sound, although mixed with a more 90s alternative. Belly to Belly to me is nearly unlistenable.
I would agree.
Yeah, and I've listened to some of their stuff. They did an album with Jamie St. James of Black and Blue, which is a solid album, and now they've got, I can't remember his name, he sang for Lynch Mob on their second album, but he's been with Warrant for a long time. They had Rockaholic and Louder, Harder, Faster, which are both solid, but doesn't compare to first three albums. But Dirty Rotten Filthy Stinking Rich to me is a solid debut. But you're right, those albums get better as they go along.
Yeah, I'm a big Ultraphobic fan.
I am too.
There's something about it. It's not like it just blows you away or anything like that, but it's just, you can sink your teeth into it. It's just more of Janie Lane writing how he wants to write. This is what's coming out. Yes, it's released in the middle of 95.
Yeah, it was never good. It never had a chance, even if it sounded like classic Warrant. It never had a chance.
You know, and they incorporate some Soundgarden. I can't fault, you know, some of these bands that are, what were they supposed to do? You know, you can't release Cherry Pie or a version of that record here in 1995. And they've got, I think, two of the original members are gone, but.
Yeah.
But anyway, I love that album.
Yeah. At the same time, though, you know, how many people that are just huge fans of Soundgarden are going to hear the new Warrant Ultraphobic and be like, oh my gosh, this is so great. You know, I'm going to blast this. They're not.
Yeah.
And people that like Cherry Pie and Dirty Rotten Filthy Stinking Rich and Dog Eat Dog are going to hear a lot of Ultraphobic and be like, this doesn't sound like Warrant. When if you listen to it, I mean, there is some classic Warrant sound of that record, but it definitely is a departure, but solid.
You know what I like? Another thing about Warrant, don't want to spend too much time on Ultraphobic because this is the 1989 episode, but some bands kind of shied away. They try to bury their their name on the album cover or like shrink it. And then make the album title the prominent text.
Yeah.
I mean, they kind of shake up the logo, I guess, but it still says Warrant, pretty large letters. Yeah. So they're like, this is who we are. And
although the picture on the album cover does look like it's a still from the Black Hole Sun video.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Bo Hill produced that album.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to make number two pretty easy because you're not going to believe it. My number two is also Dirty, Rotten, Filthy, Stinking Rich.
I think our number ones might be the same also.
Probably so. I mean, look, I'm going to throw out just a couple of my also-rans and then I'll get into more. But, you know,
yeah.
I'm leaving Kiss off the list. They've got a record this year or that year 1989, Hot in the Shade, Kiss is, they became glam for a while, but they didn't start that way. They didn't end that way. So it's, and I mean, if you could make an argument that they were glam, they still, that's not a top five album for me. Another record that's kind of on the edge, Tesla, The Great Radio Controversy, just a huge record. Doesn't make my cut because I just don't, I just always see Tesla as a rock band. And
yeah, and The Great Radio Controversy is one of those things you were talking about earlier where you've got a couple of hit singles and there's a lot of filler on that album.
Yeah. But yeah, number two for me is Warrant. I'm fascinated with Janie Lane and, you know, the guitar playing, Joey Allen, lead guitar. Another guy doesn't get talked about outside of these circles. Eric Turner, rhythm guitar. Stephen Sweet on drums. Agree with you 100% on Sometimes She Cries. That's the one for me. That's the, yeah. I like Sometimes She Cries over Heaven with those two ballads. But again,
absolutely,
not every band was capable of just cranking out two monster ballads on the same LP. So Damn Pretty should be Against the Law.
Oh, great one. Yeah.
In the Sticks and Down Boys.
I still listen to Down Boys. I'm not tired of it.
Looking up and down the record, the track listing here, Big Talk really might be my favorite song.
Good song.
That's just a total Warrant song.
Absolutely.
They just had, they had a lot of range, and unfortunately they break in 89. And 1990, they just get put in this impossible situation. They've got a whole bunch of songs written. I don't think Cherry Pie came to the studio with them. I think they had Uncle Tom's Cabin, I Saw Red. I mean, Bed of Roses.
Yeah.
Blind Faith. They've got some great songs. And the record label is asking for one more hit. And,
yeah.
I mean, they rode high on it, but I wish... Because it seems like that he just, that Janie Lane, I mean, well, he enjoyed the success that came with it, but being the cherry pie, being associated with that.
Yeah, I can see that. You're a serious songwriter, and you're known as the, as he called it, the cherry pie guy.
And we were 10, 11 when this was going on. I think if you were a senior in high school, maybe it's not the coolest thing to say that Warrant's your favorite band. Maybe that, maybe they are kind of a, maybe they appealed more to the female demographic.
Yeah.
I don't know. I always wonder what it would have been like to be in high school in 88, 89.
That's a good question, because you're going to have your metalheads that are into more of the thrashier stuff that might laugh at and pick on the guys that are into the glammy stuff. Whereas when we were 10 years old, I guess that didn't really matter. So I'm going to guess that if you're a teenager back then, it's probably more like, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie from the 80s called Trick or Treat. It's a heavy metal horror movie. But this kid, I mean, he's in everything from like Motley Crue and Judas Priest to Slayer. So I think you could probably dabble in some of the glam, but you're going to be in more of the heavier stuff on the surface, you know, overtly. But I bet when a lot of these guys go home, they're listening to glam. And I bet a lot of the thrash guys did that too. Gary Holt from Exodus once told a story how they kicked a guy off their bus. He said he was a Rat and Roller. But he says, you know, we couldn't say anything. We all secretly listened to Rat because we liked Warren DeMartini. And he said that he and Warren were at a guitar convention, and he told Warren the story. And he said that Warren got a kick out of it. So, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting to think about what it would have been like had we been older. But I'm kind of glad I was 10 years old in 1988 and 11 and 89.
I am too.
Yeah.
One other footnote here on Janie Lane. He was born John Kennedy Oswald.
Yes.
It's his given name.
Yeah. Well, I think his parents were big fans of the former president.
Apparently so. With the last name Oswald.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
Almost forgot to mention, I got to see Warrant perform one time in 1997 in Chicago. And Travis was there.
I remember that.
I can't believe I almost forgot this. I saw Alice Cooper with Warrant opening, and I want to say Slaughter was on the bill. We got there a little bit late, but Warrant put on just an incredible show. It was
there a lot of people there for, what, 1990, what do you say, 6, 97?
97. I think it was at the World Amphitheater at that time is what it was called.
Okay, a lot of people there?
Yeah, good turnout.
Yeah.
You know, you're about 10 years, because once you got to the end of the 90s, the first part of the 2000s, that's when some of the nostalgia started creeping back.
Right.
And you saw some of the tours, like you said, Poison is out on tour somewhere around 01, 02.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Alice Cooper was great, of course.
As he always is.
Well, we've made it to number one, and I can't imagine that we're going to have any difference here. I'm actually pleased. I got to say this as a compliment, Robert, that I'm in line so far with your 3-2 and probably number one because of how much you know about this genre and that our tastes are in alignment there. I'd say my one conflict or difference of opinion would be on Fraley's comment, but I'm fine because that comes from the depths of your...
Yeah. And I think that our 4 and 5s were going to be different anyway.
Yeah.
But we'll see when I reveal my number one if it's going to be the same, but like you, I do want to list a couple of also-rans.
Yeah.
I do want to mention the Bill and Ted soundtrack because that is just great all the way through. And a lot of the bands on there were unknown at the time. Some of them are still unknown. But just, you know, Shark Island's got a couple songs. They even had them. They had an album in 89.
Yep.
With Call of the Order. And then Extreme had a song on there. And then some people I'd never heard. Robbie Robb and Glenn Burknick. But just a great, great kind of a lighter glam sound, but just a fun record all the way through. I do also want to mention Guns N' Roses, GNR Lies.
Yeah.
You know, one side of that was their demo they did in 86, Live Like a Suicide. And then, of course, they did another side with acoustic covers. It's an also-ran. I like it. I know that the song One in a Million is pretty controversial because he uses some racial slurs and homophobic slurs in that. And I can't defend that song, but great acoustic version of You're Crazy. I mean, Patience is a timeless classic. Used to Love Her, great song. I'll also mention, and this isn't really glam, but it's coming up to the line. I put Aerosmith Pump, good all around record. And then last, I will put Extreme's debut album, which is a banger all the way through, but I don't think it's as good as the 5 that I've got on my list. But the Extreme debut album is great and really showcases Nuno's guitar chops. Just a fantastic guitar player and a good band. And their follow-up, Porno Graffiti, was pretty good too. But having said all that, I will say my number one is Skid Row, debut album, self-titled Skid Row. There is not one single song that I will skip. There's not one single song on this record that I do not like. And there is not one single song on this record that I am not tired of, even the singles. I still listen to 18 in Life. I still listen to I Remember You and Youth Gone Wild. But, I mean, Piece of Me, Can't Stand the Heartache, Sweet Little Sister, Midnight Tornado, Rattlesnake Shake, Making a Mess. I mean, that whole album is just, to me, it's like, I think the Black Album is just a perfect, just straight ahead metal album. It's not a thrash metal album, but it's a perfect metal album all the way through. I think Skid Row's debut album might be the best glam metal album of all time. And it's also pretty heavy. It gets into that little area where it's like, is this hair metal? Is this glam? Is this straight ahead metal? Probably all. I can't sing this album's praises enough. It's just a phenomenal record and big guns. Once you've heard that, I mean, you're already your head is blown off by the end of that song.
Yes.
I don't think that there is one bad spot on this album, and that's why it's my number one.
Well, everything you just said, I agree wholeheartedly. Obviously, when you get up here to number one, if neither one of us have mentioned Skid Row, it's got to be them. You're right, Robert. Top to bottom, for a debut, this is a band that's saying we're not just looking to get one of our singles on MTV for a few weeks. I mean, they're looking to take over the world.
Yeah.
Skid Row, self-titled debut, and Dirty, Rotten, Filthy, Stinking Rich released 1 week apart. Robert, can you imagine January 1989 going to the music store to get this record 1 week, and then the next week the debut album from Warrant?
Just one after another. I mean, I wish times were like it today, but I know they can't be. But yeah, just
hard to believe, Robert, that January 89 in the summer of 88, you know, we're out there playing with our friends or doing whatever we're doing. We don't even know about Warrant or Skid Row yet that summer, that fall.
No, not at all.
18 in Life, Youth, just the singles. My gosh. Youth Gone Wild, I Remember You. That's probably one of the best ballads from any of these bands. And Sebastian Bach, I mean, the vocals are just...
I wish I had that in my record collection. I wish I had that on CD, on physical media. I don't. It's on my damn phone. Because, I mean, I put it on right now.
Well, obviously, they, as many of these bands from this era do, very, very few, if any, stick together.
No.
30, 40 years later. I don't know if we have an example of a band that's the same for...
Poison.
Poison. Wow.
But they've had a lot of changes, too.
Guys have left and come back, but as it stands now, Poison is the same four guys.
Yeah.
I really wish, and it was a great disappointment, Robert, that Poison did not release a record in 1989, so I don't have a chance to talk about. Because you know how I feel about them and how you do as well. But yeah, just what an incredible record, and great thing about 2025 and being able to just find podcast episodes with some of these guys. Tell you what you've just never known. You know, what was it like back then? How'd you guys get started? You know, listening to Ricky Rocket on Eddie Trunk's show talking about how Poison was a lot of these bands living hand to mouth. They didn't have any food. They didn't have any money.
And what a genuine guy he comes across as when you see him in interviews.
Oh, Ricky Rocket.
He doesn't sugarcoat anything. You know, he says, we're not respected, but this is who we are, you know, and he's not trying to compare himself to anybody else. I just always found him to be very genuine and he also seems like a pretty good guy too.
Yeah. Rachel Bolan. There's a good episode with, could be Eddie Trunk, maybe Chuck Shoot podcast where Rachel really breaks down the early days.
Yeah.
They were a hard working band. And the things they had to do, the jobs that there were. Some of these guys are working jobs, working 40 hours a week, going to the rehearsal space at night, and probably, yes, taking advantage of girlfriends, getting them to buy their smokes and their beer and buy them some fast food or keep them fed, keep them alive. And I think Ricky Rocket told the story about Poison. He said, we treated our female fans, we paid special attention to the female fans who were not the knockouts.
Mm.
And they showed up at our shows. They brought their friends with them. We were a big tent for not just the hot chicks, which you would think with Poison that's all they cared about. But he said, no, we were very appreciative, and there's different way that he explained it. But getting back to Skid Row, it was just such a dominant release. They found the front man they needed. They captured lightning in a bottle. And I appreciate Sebastian Bach. I like listening to him in interviews. But I can certainly understand where after about a few years, it just kind of, it wears thin.
Oh, my God. If I went out to dinner with him, I'd probably be driven insane within 30 minutes. Be like, I mean, imagine going to dinner with Sebastian Bach and David Lee Roth. I mean, would you not be driven up the wall?
Check this out, Robert. This is just off Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Upon its release in January 1989, the debut Skid Row record did not immediately connect with listeners and received mixed reviews from the music press.
I find that hard to believe.
It took basically until the summer of 89, no, the fall, the success of I Remember You. That's when the album took off and eventually sold over 5 million copies.
That was the formula, you know, release the banger first and then the ballad. And once you release that ballad, you know, your record's going to skyrocket. I will say about this, the Skid Row record is my number one. It is number one, and The Warrant number two is a very far number two. I mean, this record is so superior to the other four on the list. By miles. I've got Sebastian Bach's book. I got it for Christmas. I'm finally going to read it this weekend. So
I would definitely read that.
Yeah, well, I'll if I finish it when I see you, I'll hand it over to you.
Well, some of these, you know, these bands, just let's just say that you have a Skid Row, even down to Faster Pussycat, or a band that's not really hell-bent on writing a power ballad. And yeah, there's a lot of resistance, and they're saying, no, we don't play those songs live. This is what we do. This is what we sound like. You know, F off in so many words. And there had to have been some bands that just said, no, we're not going to do it. But just imagine if Skid Row had not said, okay, we'll give you something, and we'll get to work on what became I Remember You. What would have happened?
The album would have sold okay. You know, you and I would have heard it. We would have thought this is a great, probably heavy metal record. Mm-hmm. But it would have been in those list of forgotten albums. It would have been on that list. But I think I Remember You, that song makes it a hair metal album, but it also blows them up and reaches a much wider audience. But then probably also sets the stage for Slave to the Grind 2 years later.
Right.
That's another conversation in itself too, but just God, I can't get enough of the debut album of Skid Row. Absolutely number one. I don't know how anybody could do a list of 89 glam metal albums and not have that debut as number one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I've got some also-rans. One in particular that I want to highlight here. This thing just really, really frustrates me.
Yeah.
Shark Island. They make an appearance on the Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure soundtrack.
Yeah.
But their record, Law of the Order, really just dead on arrival. I don't know if that's completely accurate, but
it was. Just no promotion.
And I look at this, some things just on a basic level, again, what I'm talking about frustrates me. You go back to 89, there's no social media, there's MTV, but you go to the music store to find CDs that you want to check out. And sometimes you just base that off the album cover. I'm looking at this album cover, Law of the Order. This is a catastrophe.
Yeah.
This is horrific. Yeah. The band's logo, Shark Island, is just atrocious.
Yeah. Horrible album. Yeah.
The scene with the guys, and I don't even know what's happening there. You just see some things, some separation on records that made it big versus records that didn't. Warrants, Dirty, Rotten, Filthy, Stinking Rich. If you're just thumbing through and you get to the W's and you see that, that big fat cat figure.
Yeah.
You're going to take a flyer on that record. You maybe flip to the back and see who the label, you know, what label they're on if you're astute enough to check that out at the time, and you're going to buy it. You're not buying this Shark Island record based on that.
No.
But if you do take it home and listen to it, wow, you're in for a treat. Get some Strange, Band for Each Other.
Yeah.
Wow. When I don't know if you remember their cover of Fleetwood Mac's The Chain.
Yeah.
The last song and the solo at the end.
Yeah.
So these guys were loaded with talent, just some fatal decisions there, but maybe not entirely their own. And I'm sure there's a lot more to the story. But I had a few on here that are good albums, and they're acclaimed albums too. Talking about album covers, this was a pretty good one for the time. L.A. Guns, Cocked and Loaded.
Oh, great, great album cover. And pretty decent album too. I was never a huge L.A. Guns fan. I think they had some good songs, but they did have a lot of filler.
Danger, Danger, self-titled. I do like that album. Like the singer.
Oh my gosh. I should have mentioned that on my also reads. That is a solid album. On the lighter side of glam metal, like Boys Will Be Boys, One Step from Paradise is a good ballad, but it doesn't even sound like glam. It's like something you would dance to at your sixth grade dance or something, but pretty solid song. But all around a good debut. Their two follow-ups after that one are better. They're kind of like Warrant. They improve with every album. And they put out records up until about 2010. But yeah, Danger, Danger. I'm glad you mentioned them. Really good band, overlooked for whatever reason.
And then maybe one final one here. Well, I've got White Lion, Big Game. Wasn't really a candidate, but we did see them, as you said, with Aerosmith when we were in like fourth grade.
Yeah, I mean, technically, I guess White Lion would be the first band that we saw live.
That's right. yep. So
they have to hold a special place in our hearts.
I've heard, and I think it is on the 80s Glam Metal Cast, if you go way back, lead singer
Mike Tramp.
Yeah, Mike Tramp. He's on an episode there. He talks a lot about the history of White Lion, so
yeah,
check that one out.
Yeah. Well, I would say, look, on that album, I'll just mention Little Fighter, obviously, was a minor hit. But check out the song Living on the Edge. Really, really rocks. Wasn't a single, kind of a deep track, but it is one that I go back to a lot.
Well, a lot more we could cover here. We're going to have to do a similar episode. But like I said, I realized that for the Dan Time podcast, I was on episode 88, and we were just about out of the 80s. I just couldn't let it happen. I mean, we could have justified it, but episode 89, a discussion of glam metal, hair metal. I don't think anybody's ever settled on one way to describe it, but from that year, it was fun. Robert, we've talked about the bands, the songs. How about just being that age and the cassette player, the Walkman, listening to I-95, and the experience of being a kid and this music and how it made you feel?
What a great time to be alive, to be a kid. The later generations, your kids, my kids, Travis's kids will never understand that. And, you know, we can pound that into them about how great it was. They'll never relate to it, and it's a shame that they can't and will never get to experience what we experienced. But just a great time to be a kid, I would think.
Well, it was...
At least in America or Europe or Western Europe. But, yeah, just a fun time and just the best music. Everything was so magical almost.
Right. We didn't even talk about TV shows, but there was still anticipation of, you know, you had to wait a week to see the next episode of a TV show that you liked. You didn't have it all at once. There was really not instant gratification. Just, it really didn't manifest itself. I can't think of a good example. I mean, now you've got a lot of things that you want to access at your fingertips. You know, either your phone or your TV remote, or you just have stuff everywhere.
I was having this conversation with my neighbor last week. He's a teacher. He teaches seventh grade English, and we were talking about MTV, and he was wondering, well, what if they had something like that now? How would the you know, the younger generation, would it work? And I said, I don't think it would, because they have access to whatever they want to listen to at their fingertips. And so they're not going to sit through 10 videos to watch, you know, the new Taylor Swift song or, you know, whoever's big right now.
Yeah. What was, wasn't there a Faster Pussycat song called Don't Change That Song?
Yeah. Don't Change That Song. It's my favorite record.
Yeah.
Off the date.
That may not have been speaking to what you were just referencing there, where it's like, don't change the channel. Don't change the dial. Keep it locked right here. Well, you don't have to keep it locked right here anymore. You can go do something else and come back, and you can listen to any of these songs that we're talking about in this episode immediately.
Right.
You don't have to. I remember waiting, turning on MTV and just waiting to see Nothing But a Good Time. You knew when it was hot that summer or whenever it was that it was coming on, but you didn't know if it was going to be within the half hour or not.
Yeah.
Great stuff. Yeah. Coming back to the list here, just reading it on paper and the ones that you shared, those videos come back to me.
Yes.
The Warrant videos, the Crew videos, Skid Row, and Alice Cooper Trash. I remember watching. I remember Feed My Frankenstein, of course, from the Wayne's World movie.
Yeah, yeah. It was I'll blow down your house and then I'm gonna eat you.
I listened to that song not too long ago.
But I don't want pizza. What?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't want pizza.
Yeah, I'll blow down your house and then I'm gonna eat you.
He's got a few songs like that. Remember Hey Stupid?
Yeah.
STOOPID.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
We could talk about this. We could talk about this for a whole week.
Probably. Yeah. Well, that's it. If you have a top five list of your own from 1989, if you're following along with what we're saying, if you were there, or if you're 20-something years old, but you know a lot about this genre, send me your list, dantimepod@gmail.com, or post a comment on the Dan Time Pod Instagram page and get into the conversation. Disagree with us, agree with us, and let me hear from you. So I'll create another excuse for us to talk again, Robert.
Yeah, this was a treat. We should explore some more years in glam, or we could even delve into some thrashier stuff. But this was a lot of fun.
Agreed. Well, that's it. Pop in one of these albums. Check out some of these bands that we talked about that you maybe forgot about or never knew. And just roll the windows down, put on your sunglasses, crank it up, and play some air guitar at the next red light. And just have some fun with this music that we so enjoy. That's it for this episode of the Dan Time Podcast. We'll see you next Sunday. Have a great week. Thank you, Robert.
All right. Always a pleasure. Thank you.